This must be a very exciting time for you, the 50th anniversary of...
It's very thrilling to think about such a durable book. It's been going a long time, and a lot of people read it. It's been translated into over 40 languages. I travel a great deal, and wherever I go, I sort of check around to see if I find Steinbeck books. I've had great fun on the trail of Grapes of Wrath all over the world. It sells in the United States alone 100,000 copies, paperbacks, a year. After 50 years, that's pretty remarkable, isn't it?
Well, I would say so, yeah. And I think the book has always been in print since 1939.
It's always been in print, yes, it has. It's still relevant, too, in a strange way. It told of an odd time. May I tell you something Mrs. Roosevelt said about it once?
Sure.
She was meeting my husband for the first time. I was with him. And she said, she had a little voice like this. She said, whenever I'm in the Soviet Union, they ask me if those same conditions can prevail in the United States that prevailed when John Steinbeck wrote The Grapes of Wrath. And I say no, that Franklin Delano Roosevelt and John Steinbeck made sure that they couldn't. And my husband turned and said quietly to me, "That's why I write." And I always think that's a wonderful, wonderful reaction. And even though there's been no more sort of mass migration as in those days, and the conditions are not the same, Mrs. Roosevelt was right there, still it is relevant. There has been a great drought, as you know, in the Middle West. The banks do still foreclose on the small farmer, and people still are dispossessed. And it's amazing they keep reading The Grapes of Wrath. Somebody said, I think, to Studs Terkel, "What's the best book you read in 1988? And he said, "The Grapes of Wrath."
Well, it's interesting. The conditions, as you just mentioned, are different. I think we learned a lot after the Dust Bowl about farming.
Oh, we did. Plowing the land and preserving the topsoil of the land. I think a lot of it came from that. And we certainly know that Cesar Chavez's unions for the grape pickers and all certainly all the protection for the itinerant gatherer and pickers came from the Steinbeck time, certainly. Not only from John, I don't mean to be, that's pompous, but from people who believed that it had to happen to protect the people. And when John said to me, "That's why I write," he meant, isn't it marvelous that I have made an impact on my country and my countrymen? He always wrote about the people. He says all the way through The Grapes of Wrath, "We, the people, we," you know.
Well, yeah, and his characters endure, the Tom Joad, and the characters in Mice and Men, Lenny. These are unforgettable characters. Mice and Men is a little tiny book, too.
Yes. And the sun never sets on that play. It's playing somewhere in the world all the time. You know, the thing that's, my husband, I lived with him I was married to him the last 20 years of his life. And he was very well known at this point, and all over the world. And I've seen him sit at a table with intellectuals, for instance, at the French Academy in Paris. And I would learn things that I didn't even knew because he was speaking to his peers. But when he went to Sag Harbor, Eastern Long Island, where we've had a house since the 1950s, he talked to the scallopers and fishermen just the same way. That's one of the best things I can say about my husband. He never lost the touch of his touch with the people he first lived with and the people he first wrote about. They were the ones he cared about.
And you would describe him as an intellectual?
No, I don't believe I would say John was in the intellectual community here. As a matter of fact, and I'm bringing it up, there were people who in the intellectual community who objected when he got the Nobel Prize. And it must have hurt him terribly. But his reaction was wonderful because he was a gallant man. But I just said whenever he was with intellectuals, he could hold his own and spoke to them in the same way that he spoke to the people.
What was the reaction in the Steinbeck household when it was learned that he won the Nobel?
He and I were in Sag Harbor on Eastern Long Island, and I was cooking breakfast, and it was the time of the So this is one of my very favorite stories. It was the time of the Cuban Missile Crisis, and we were all so concerned, of course. And I was making breakfast, and I said, why don't you turn on the television or radio and find out if the world is still turning? And the first words we heard, just by accident, were, this morning John Steinbeck was awarded the Nobel Prize for Literature. There was jubilation, I tell you.
Got the champagne bottles there.
Well, it was a little early for that, but the phone started ringing, and our children were away in school, and we phoned and told them. And we came into town for a press conference, and there was jubilation. We had a lot. He was thrilled. Every time the Nobel Prize season would approach, there would be rumors, had been for 3 or 4 years, that John was going to win the prize. And it upset him very much when people said that. You know, he'd say, don't be so absurd. And he always said to me, don't ever mention that. So we never discussed it. And I can understand that. It sounded self-important. And he was very pleased. It is the highest award a writer can write. And the thing he liked to do best in life was to write. He was only happy when he was writing, really.
You went over to Sweden for the...
They were a glorious 5 days.
Norway.
It's Stockholm.
Oh, Stockholm.
Yeah, yeah. The Peace Prize is in Norway, but all the literature laureates. We were there at a very exciting time. James Watson, the American who, with the two British, won the Nobel scientific awards for the makeup of DNA, and he was the youngest man ever to win the Nobel Prize. And John, it was a very exciting time. There are 5 days of celebrations, parties, formal receptions. The king presents the medal, and the Swedish Academy presents the parchment, which tells why you won the award. It's not given for a one particular work, as you know, to literature. It's given for the body of the work.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's a nice story. My husband's always described as a two-fisted drinker. And he was a good drinker. But he said to me, several weeks before we went over, will you do something with me in Stockholm? And I said, sure, what? And he said, I always love the way he phrased this. He said, with the possible exception of Pearl Buck, I think every American writer who's ever gotten the Nobel Prize has spent those 5 days there pretty boozed up. Would you go with me and we not drink a drop? And I said, yes, sure. I imagine it'd be hard. There are a lot of parties, lots of skull, you know. But he said, I'll be representing myself, my country, and my profession.
Mm.
And he didn't. So you see, he had... good sense, too.
Yeah, but he was never a sloppy drinker.
Oh, no, of course not. Of course he was.
No, I never got that impression. I've read the...
No, but he wrote about people drinking, and he was the Cattery Row crowd did drink.
Right. Well, how did he reconcile his work as a writer with his work as a husband and father?
He always worked at home. He complained a great deal when they found the diary that he kept during the Grapes of Wrath. This was before I'd met him, of course, before I was married to him. I read the diary and I thought he didn't change much. He came, everything was too noisy no matter how quiet it was. He was like, I suppose most writers, he was easy to live with when the writing was going well and hell to live with when it was going badly. At first when I married him, I didn't know this and I thought, what have I done to upset him? And I found pretty soon that was, he was stuck a bit.
So he could be cranky at times.
Hey, oh, cranky. The thing that was that I learned that was very interesting, I'm a talker, and I would, telling him everything in the neighborhood and all the gossip, and he was receptive, but there would be when he was planning a book, he always planned it before he sat down to write it. There would be a time when I knew I was totally, he wasn't hearing a thing. He was being polite, but completely blanking out anything anybody said to him. So that was reasonable. But he did write at home, and he would love a word processor, but alas, he missed it. He wrote with pencil and paper.
Oh, yeah. He wrote actually by hand, didn't he?
That's... He wrote by hand. He wrote a lot. He was a big letter writer. A friend, Robert Walston, and I in the 70s edited, Viking published a book of John's letters called Steinbeck at Life in Letters. And he wrote, we asked for letters, and we got 5,000. So you see, he wrote letters, and people did save them. But he always said that he didn't like a machine. He typed when he very often when he wrote. Sometimes he did wrote, but he used the typewriter. But in creative writing, he always wrote by hand. He felt something got between him and the, but that's very old fashioned. He probably wouldn't do that today.
Did he have a secretary to type his things?
Sometimes he had a secretary. No, he didn't have a secretary. It's a general thing at all.
So he would. Then, after he wrote in longhand, would then copy them.
He got up early in the morning in the city or in the country, usually took a walk. He said in the country he wanted to see what the birds were doing or hear what the birds were saying. He came back and wrote almost always in the daylight till early afternoon. Then he had time to read or fish or invent. Or
to what?
Invent. He was always inventing something to do something better than somebody else. The foolishness, things around the household.
Such as?
Oh, let's see. I don't know right now. That you're catching me off guard. He was always inventing a better way to do something. To wash socks if you lived in a camper. or to do something in the garden. He would make little models. He was a whittler. He covered things in leather and he made things of wood. He said after he had worked all day using his mind, he liked to use his hands. See, he grew up in California, close to the land and near the sea.
You mentioned a camper. He did have a camper.
He did when he did
travels with
when he did travels with Charlie. Oh, we fixed that camper up for 6 months before he finally took off in it, alone, except for Charlie, who was my dog, incidentally. He borrowed my dog for travels with Charlie. But he worked on that camper to make it livable, you see, and all kinds of gadgets and crazy things. There was a thing, incidentally, I don't know quite how to describe it to you, in which you put your underwear and your socks, and you hung it in a thing and hung it up in the camper so that with suds and soap flakes and water, and when you drove the next day, it jiggled around and washed them, you see. This, of course, was for fun because it amused him. That was one of his inventions.
But you and John did travel quite a bit, didn't you?
John and I traveled a great deal. He had begun to travel a great deal before we met, and then we found that we liked to travel. One of the good things is he could write almost anywhere. He did a lot of journalism. He wrote for. He started out writing for that distinguished paper in the South called the Louisville Courier Journal, and then he wrote later a lot of things for Newsday on Long Island, and. He could write wherever he was, and he wrote short stories. One year we had a house in Paris. One year we had a house in a meadow in Somerset in England. But always never chic, never fashionable kind of thing. We almost always lived near the people. Not near groups of expatriates. You see what I mean? Mm-hmm. So that when he was dying, he said to me, "What's the best time we ever had together in our marriage?" And I said, "You tell me first." And he said, "No, you would cheat and agree with me." And I said, "All right, I'll write it on a piece of paper and put it in your hand." He was taking oxygen. He really was dying. And I put it in his hand, and I said, "All right, what's the best time we ever had together?" And he said, "The year in Somerset." And I said, "Open your hand." And I had written Somerset. Isn't that a nice story?
Oh, a lovely story.
We had lived, he was doing research on a book he never wrote called about King Arthur. All of his life he lived with the King Arthur legend. You find some of it in Tortilla Flat. And various books. There's always a little bit of something. Not always, but sometimes King Arthur. So we were in Somerset. We were near one of the spots, which is the legendary Camelot. and we were near Glastonbury, the ruin of the cathedral, and marked clearly are the graves of King Arthur and Guinevere. So he was doing research there, and we had a wonderful time. And we lived in a small village, about 1,000 people, in an ancient cottage listed in the Doomsday Book of William the Conqueror. The foundation of the cottage was. And we both loved that. We're both kind of history nuts.
But he did have a book posthumously published about
this. This is just a sort of first draft. He was freely translating, not freely at the beginning, literally translating the Thomas Malory, the Malorian book from the ancient manuscript. And then he was going to work from it. But I felt after I read it, after he died, that after he began to translate it, he also began to leave the Malory and to embroider and to put a lot of his own research in it. And I thought it was a good thing to go on and publish it. It's just a fragment. We call it a work in progress.
Mm-hmm. How did you meet John Steinbeck?
In California. He was divorced. And
you were married to Zachary Scott.
I was married to Zachary Scott. And I was living with Zach in Hollywood, yes. I was married to Zach for 14 years. And John was divorced. He had two very young children. And he was very sad and very angry and very upset, and he came back to his little, his family. He was born in Salinas, but he and his father had built a little house, a very small house in a walled garden near the sea in Pacific Grove. That's the Monterey Peninsula, you know. It's right near Cannery Row, right at the end of Cannery Row. And he had moved back to live there, and I met him, and we fell in love.
So you had a love affair that ultimately led to your divorce.
Yes, uh-huh. A mutual friend introduced us. I was a big Steinbeck fan. I had read, and it applies, when I was young, but still a woman, I went through part of the dust storms. I didn't know John then. But when I read The Grapes, I'd read The Grapes of Wrath long before I met my husband. But I had relatives in what's called the Panhandle of Texas. That's the part that sticks up by Oklahoma. And when I visited up there, it was almost impossible to breathe. I remember sitting in a very beautiful house, very well-built house, with a drink and with a paper napkin over it, because the dust was just seeping in, and you couldn't see the sky. I must have been about 18 or 19 then, and I lived through the Dust Bowl, and I was, when I read The Grapes of Wrath, I had already read Steinbeck, but I had absolutely flipped over it because it was part of my experience, too.
Yeah. What brought you and John East from California?
I had lived here and worked here with the Theater Guild and worked in the theater. I was a woman stage manager on Broadway when there were very few. We came to become stars on Broadway. We acted in Texas together, and we married, and we came here, and we decided one of us should get a 12-month-a-year job, and one should try for. It's such a precarious existence to try to live off the theater, but Zach was the logical one, and he made it. You see, he became a very good actor and a Hollywood star, and I was out. With him a little while, not for very long. But I took a leave of absence from my job and went out there. And there was nothing to keep me there, really, because I didn't have any experience working in the theater, in the movies. So I had said to John when I first met him, I'm going back to New York. And he said, well, I've just left there because of my divorce. He had lived here, you see. Mm-hmm. And so when we fell in love, we decided I think he felt you really can't go home again. It was so changed. You know, California was the fastest growing state, and at that time may still be for all I know, but it had changed. Whenever somebody treated him like a person instead of a celebrity, he was happy there. I know one of the first things he told me when I met him in that little cottage where he lived, which is mine now, but it will go back to the Steinbeck family, of course. But he said the old man, John had just come back to this little house, to lick his wounds and his sadness. And there was an old man who lived next door, and he had shouted out to John and said, "Aren't you Ernest Steinbeck's son?" And John said, "Yes, sir, I am." And the man said, "Been away?" So he liked that part of it. But in general, he felt, I don't know, he said to me, wasn't it lucky when Scott Fitzgerald and Ernest Hemingway and the contemporary, right, his contemporaries, went to Paris? And you know they did. They went to Paris and lived and wrote. And he said, "Isn't it good that I didn't have the price of a ticket?" He stayed. He wrote his best books there, you see, at home. I heard E.L. Doctorow say, I think he's a great American writer, and in a lecture once he said, he was talking about to young writers, he said, when you start out, at least when you start out, you must write about what you know, what you come from. He said there were many great writers around during the America's Great Depression, but only Steinbeck wrote The Grapes of Wrath.
Yeah, he really caught it, and it's just amazing. This book is read and read and reread and reread.
So he wrote about the people he knew.
Yeah, and you were with him when he wrote East of Eden.
That's the first book he wrote after we married. Yes, I feel very close to that book. He had said to me when I first met him, "I'll never write another book. I'm too miserable, disillusioned." And I'm glad, proud to say that as soon as we were married, he sat down and wrote East of Eden.
He did a lot of that on Long Island, didn't he?
He did it here on in New York and Long Island, as we, yes.
Mm-hmm. Well, all of the, I noticed that there's a Steinbeck Quarterly. I guess there are Steinbeck Clubs. I mean, his name just keeps going on and on, doesn't
it? There's a big Steinbeck Society in Japan. There's a big Steinbeck Society in India. They all write me. They all invite me to come. I'm in close touch with them, all of them, and the Soviet has just had, the Soviet Writers Union, I understand, just had a Steinbeck evening celebrating the Grapes of Wrath. So I think it's been celebrated, being celebrated this week particularly, all over the world, I'm glad to say.
Well, I know this is an exciting week.
It is.
Interviews for you. And
I'm awfully glad to share it with you. It's my pleasure.
Well, you certainly do know your subject, that's for sure. Lynn Steinbeck, thank you very much.
Thank you so much, too.